You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Chris Wilson, a senior lecturer from the University of Auckland, and colleague James Halpin have recently published two papers on James Halpin's infiltration of the right-wing extremist group Action Zealandia. They found that online spaces were places where extremism flourished, and meeting in real life disrupted the process of radicalization. One line in one of the papers reads, "Compared to their heroic online avatars, many young white nationalists are awkward, disorganized, and uninspiring in real life." Today I spoke to Chris Wilson about the nuances of the research, including the challenge of having an insidious group that instead of having immediate goals of violence, instead has long-term aims for recruitment and spread of racist rhetoric. I started by asking for an overview of Action Zealandia as a group.
Action Zealandia was formed out of a small group of members of the Dominion Movement, which folded up after the Christchurch attacks in March 2019. Action Zealandia formed from a number of individuals from that. They outwardly present a representation of themselves as clean living community of European young men mostly, but inwardly and in private online forums they're white supremacist, white nationalist, fascist, neo-Nazi, and extremist. So they've been in operation since about mid-2019. Most members based in Auckland, but small numbers in several cities across New Zealand.
And the approach of infiltration is obviously incredibly time-consuming and potentially dangerous. Could you explain the rationale behind undertaking this blended research approach and what mitigating measures your colleague took to protect himself and maintain ethical standards?
There's an ongoing discussion in, within social sciences, but particularly focused on organisations like this, extremist organisations, over the best and most feasible way of obtaining information. We have decided to infiltrate the group, or James decided to infiltrate the group as a way, and I came on board to help with the analysis and the research, as a way of understanding the nature of the group and as a way of determining the risks that it posed of extremist violence, particularly generally, but in particular towards ethnic minorities in New Zealand. The only way that we could, James was able to find out this information, was through infiltration and being able to participate in the group and find out what they were, their attitudes and their activities behind the scenes, if you like. He took a number of measures. He maintained his anonymity, but all that was the practice of the group. All members maintained their anonymity. He didn't participate in any activities that encouraged the group or that were illegal, of course. And mainly once he was invited to join the group, observed the group. So he maintained his safety and didn't participate in the group's activities in any way that would change the behaviour of other members in the group. We discussed his safety and his role over that period. At the same time, we also our main ethical obligation is within researching extremist organisations that potentially pose the risk of extremist violence towards ethnic minorities in New Zealand. Our main ethical obligation was to those communities, to those vulnerable communities. But at the same time, we also maintained high ethical standards in terms of maintaining the anonymity of all group members. We've made sure that no information about any of those members has been released through our research, and made sure that no harm was brought to any of the members above and beyond, any risks were brought to those members above and beyond their participation in the group in the first place.
I'm intrigued by your discussion in one of the papers about reconciliation between the online persona and the extreme imagined online persona and the real life, I suppose, would be the phrasing. Could you explain for listeners that discrepancy and what it might mean for radicalization online?
So there's a growing recognition in the study of extremism that there are absolute seas and high volumes of extremism online. I think, you know, we all recognise that there's a lot of what we sometimes refer to, some of the literature refers to as violent talk online. People often have quite extremist personalities and engage in extremist rhetoric, even talk about violence and make threats of violence. But we've long recognised, both within the research into violent extremism as well as among government practitioners tasked with preventing this, that it's a very tiny minority of people who actually put those attitudes and that rhetoric into action in the offline world. So for a number of years now, a lot of the focus in research on extremism, violent extremism, has been to try and work out why that is the case. Firstly, to work out why that is the case, and also hopefully to be able to identify which people are more likely to go on and put their rhetoric into action. One of the things that came out in our research and that we've argued is that there is a strong discrepancy between the way people act online and the way that they act offline. I think it's becoming reasonably well known now that people say things online and they act online, particularly when it's anonymous, but even when it's not, people say things that they would never say offline. That's because offline or face-to-face, in person, they can face retribution, they can face sanction and punishment for the way if they acted that way. But online, there's often no consequences for the things that you say. So we're trying to understand why, how that plays out and the real reasons for that discrepancy. Some of the findings are coming out of the study of the way people act in online gaming and other forums, that people often act in a way that where they through which they are creating their ideal persona online, the type of person that they would like to be in an ideal world, or that they dream of being, somebody who might be a little bit unconfident in real life, or not particularly influential or of high status, online is able to create a persona which is the opposite. So they create a persona in which they're brave, they are heroic, they're very confident, they're influential. And of course, the more that you post and the more extreme things that you post online in many forums these days, the more status you get. So the more followers you get, the more likes, the more dopamine the hits that you get from likes, and the more, particularly over time within particular forums, you gain a level of status that you've never enjoyed that you've never enjoyed in real life. So this is a dynamic one of several dynamics that influences people to be more extreme online than they actually are in the real world. At the same time, in the study of the way people post about issues about which they are outraged within society, for example, the internet has, as we write in one of our articles, the internet has allowed people to become familiar with a whole range of topics and issues within society and in politics in general about which they can become outraged. In the past, that they, you know, issues that they probably would never have been aware of, and they are now given the opportunity to express outrage and express an opinion on things that is very easy to do on the internet. So the threshold for expressing outrage, for expressing a strong opinion, for expressing this new form of identity is much lower than in the real world. All of these dynamics add up to people acting in ways that in the extremist space, in trying to understand violent extremism, adds up to people acting much more extreme than they are in the real world, and actually saying things that they don't even necessarily believe or mean, and certainly not things that they're going to put into action.
And that being said, online they do partake in violent talk, but regardless, the group's policy, I suppose the word would be, is to not commit violence right now against minority groups. What is the rationale behind not committing violent extreme acts? There's a lot of talk in your papers about optics. Could you explain that a little bit for listeners?
Yeah. So the first point to make, and this is a point that we make very strongly in our articles, and it's being picked up in coverage of the articles, you know, in the better coverage of the articles, is that we make the point that these groups are not by any means. It's not that they don't pose any harm. They do. Their very presence holds the potential to provoke other individuals to violence. There are actually studies that show that the presence of a far right extremist group in a city means that there is a higher likelihood of far-right extremist violence in that city, even though it's not the group itself doing it. So it can provoke people on the periphery. It can provoke other people who are not connected to the group. Their rhetoric and their very presence, you know, through public presence, through photos, social media, podcasts, whatever it may be, their stickers that they put on poles around the city, intimidates minorities in particular. So it's not that they don't cause harm, but your question is a really good one, because this is the paradox, is that it's an extremist group that ultimately is established with very white nationalist extremist goals. And so the paradox has been that in the 3 years of its existence, it hasn't yet engaged in extremist violence. We tried to understand that. And the dynamics are Several key things. Probably, I think the most important is to keep in mind the social and political context of New Zealand is stable. It's not highly polarised. Plus, it's a functioning society with pretty effective law and order and intelligence services. Plus, at the same time, the group, by its very nature, it needs to grow, it needs to create a social movement, and it needs recruits. So it has a very visible presence. It has, like I say, podcast, social media, website, and so on. For all of those reasons, any time that any of the members do something illegal or do something, make a threat or get in trouble with the police, it brings a great deal of pressure on the group and attention to the group from police, also anti-fascist activists, and also media. That attention has encouraged or made the group's leaders believe that engaging in extremist violence would be counterproductive to these broader goals of establishing a white nationalist, you know, racist, extremist social movement, because it would easily be quashed by police and by the security services if members were to engage in violence. That's the key thing to keep in mind. There have been a few other more minor dynamics. People are very, as I've said, people are very extreme and heroic online. When they meet offline, they're not quite as inspiring, and this pathway to radicalisation, or this belief that there is something brewing and there's a social movement growing, kind of gets deflated by the fact that people have met offline and it's not quite as inspiring and as exciting as they thought when they were just interacting online. So I think those are the main dynamics that have led to the group not engaging in violence. The group's also hasn't been particularly successful in growing and attracting recruits. The numbers have remained, you know, pretty small, really, about 30 people over that 3 years. So it hasn't, which again, got, you know, talks to the context of New Zealand society and politics.
That was me speaking with Chris Wilson, a co-author on two papers that document and analyse the infiltration of Action Delandia, a right-wing group in Aotearoa. And if you want to read those papers yourself, the first is titled How Online Interaction Radicalises While Group Involvement Restrains, a case study of Action Zealandia from 2019 to 2021, and the second is titled Explaining the Gap Between Online Violent Extremism and Offline Inaction Among Far-Right Groups, a study of Action Zealandia from 2019 to 2021. And I'll put both those titles in the podcast version later.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.